I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to our Fall Oncology Nursing Series. As today we talk about the management of Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma with Dr. Stephen Ansell from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and Ms. Robin Klebib, also from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And I'm particularly going to be interested to hear about the lymphoma team at Mayo Clinic and how they work together. As we go through this today, we'll look to Robin to talk about patient education issues, but also biopsychosocial considerations. And she's going to present four of her patients today. We're going to hear about what makes it different to take care of these four people compared to four other people with the same oncology situations, but different biopsychosocial backgrounds. For Dr. Ansell, we'll look to him to talk about oncology strategy. How does a medical oncologist take FDA approvals, clinical research data, and their own clinical experience and integrate that into a treatment recommendation? And how do you explain that to a patient, why you're doing or suggesting what you're doing? Here are the four lymphomas that we're going to talk about today. For each one, we'll hear about one of Robin's cases. But we're going to start out each section. I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that are new in the field. And what I'm going to be particularly interested in is how does the Mayo Clinic lymphoma team deal with new agents and new therapies. So we're going to start out talking about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. What a great topic in terms of new things. So I want to start out with this, which is agents that have been improved in the last couple years in diffuse large B-cell in the relapse setting. For patients who've already had CAR-T or not candidates for CAR-T or transplant, these are four options that are now all approved. And I want to kind of get a little bit of a feel over the last couple of years how the Mayo Clinic lymphoma team deals with all these new approvals that are coming in. Robin, you were just before we started mentioning the fact that the lymphoma team gets together for a clinicians meeting. Can you talk about who goes to that meeting and what are some of the things you talk about?
Certainly. Yeah, Steve started doing these a number of years ago, and it involves all of the providers. So the consultants, which that's our physicians at Mayo Clinic, we call them consultants, and it's our nurse practitioners, and it's our hematology pharmacist, and also our advanced fellows who are specializing in lymphoma. So we bring up various topics, new medications that we want our pharmacists to go over with us, or any other practice updates or any issues we're seeing.
So let's maybe use this as an example. And Steve, we talked about the fact all of a sudden oncologists are so many questions, they don't even know the names of half of these things, and yet they're approved, ready to go. They got to pick them out. From a broad point of view, can you talk about these four options? And we'll get a little bit more into how your team deals with it when a new one comes along. But right now, how you think through these four potential options. You know, polatuzumab is approved given with BR chemo immunotherapy. Selinexor as a single agent. Tafasitamab with lenalidomide, a so-called L-MIND combination. And Lonca-T, as we call it, an antibody drug conjugate like polatuzumab. Steve, can you kind of provide an overview of these four options that patients have? And how do you decide sort of which one comes first?
I think it's really a huge blessing, if you like, that we have all these new therapies that really are exciting and great opportunities for treating patients. I think it's making a big difference. But I think, as you mentioned, the challenge is often to decide exactly which is the best treatment to use when. And I think in our practice, a lot of it depends on what was used before that then determines what's your best choice now. So just running through the list briefly, polatuzumab vedotin is targeting a B-cell marker, CD79B. It's an antibody drug conjugate. And, it's an agent that we very commonly are using, especially around CAR T-cell therapy. And we often use it as bridging treatment. So that's kind of a place where we would have that as a niche, if you like, at least in our practice. Tafasitamab is a treatment that is usually used in combination with lenalidomide. And if you got a lot of lenalidomide before, that might be something that we would use a little less of. But that's a very effective therapy, in particular when we're looking to be able to give something for a long time. That's a combination that we like a lot. As Robin pointed out, the loncastuximab is an agent that's now recently approved. It's also an antibody drug conjugate. That is a therapy that's very promising, also targets CD19. And that is an agent that we would typically, again, use for a more finite course of treatment because, unfortunately, these payloads will begin to cause some toxicities in the longer term. Selinexor, being an oral drug, has its merits where we could then use that also for the long term, and it has to do with controlling the influx and efflux of proteins and other molecules in and out of the nucleus. And so that's an agent that we would think of if we're looking for something for the longer term. So each of these have their place, and often with large cell lymphoma patients, we need to go from one to another, so we would often use many of them.
So, you know, in general oncology practice, they've got to deal with all cancers. It's not just lymphomas, myeloma, bladder cancer. It's got five lines of therapy approved, metastatic disease. So a real challenge. And Robin, you know, what the patients want to know is what's the potential benefit, what's the potential risk. We'll get into that in a second. But one of the themes here is of these four agents, two of them are antibody drug conjugates, polatuzumab and Lonca-T, and Lonca-T was the most recent of these that was approved just in this past April. You know, antibody drug conjugates are really exploding all through oncology. I just mentioned in the cancer of the cervix, there's a newly approved one. So kind of a cool mechanism people talk about as a Trojan horse delivery of chemotherapy. How do you explain to a patient what's the difference between an antibody drug conjugate, for example, and real and sort of chemotherapy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell them it's so that the antibody part of it is it's sort of like a targeted therapy, and patients like to hear that it's really specific to their lymphoma or their cell. And so you have this antibody that is finding the tumor cell, and then it's basically I think of it as injecting it directly into the cell. And so some of the side effects they might have would be related to the antibody, whether it's infusion reaction, and then they may have chemotherapy side effects related to the actual drug part, whether that's some nausea, fatigue, blood counts going down, that sort of thing.
So, and I guess theoretically, these antibody drug conjugates, Steve, it's not 100% that the only place it delivers is chemotherapy. As Robin was suggesting, normal tissues do get exposed, and you can see chemotherapy-like side effects. What do you see with polatuzumab, for example, Steve?
So generally, again, because of the fact that, as Robin said, we'd love to believe every single molecule only went to the tumor cell, but probably some of it falls off along the way and probably macrophages eat it up, and possibly there are other places where it may stop along the way. The main side effects are the lower blood counts, and the main side effects also are neuropathy, just again because of the payload having an effect similar in the family to vincristine and those kinds of agents.
So, Robin, neuropathy is such a common symptom or side effect from chemotherapy and many different systemic therapy in general. I'm kind of curious, and particularly as it relates to polatuzumab, how you prepare a patient, and what do you tell them that let you know about specifically as it relates to neuropathy, and what are some of the things you look for when you examine a patient or you meet with a patient who's on a drug that can cause peripheral neuropathy?
Mm-hmm. So I definitely want to see, I want to know if they have any baseline neuropathy for any reason. And then you want to use words that they might understand. So we often talk about numbness or tingling or even pain, but sometimes I get a little descriptive as far as, okay, do you feel like you can't feel the floor, or do you feel like you've got a rolled up sock in your shoe? Or you feel like you're walking on pebbles? Any electrical symptoms that you're noticing? I always tell them that for the first few cycles, they might not necessarily notice anything, but we want them to keep track. And we'll be asking you about this every time you come in. And because with each dose, it can get a little bit worse. Typically, it's reversible, but not always. So what I don't want to see is that it gets so bad to the point where they're having trouble, for instance, walking because they either can't feel the floor or because it's so painful. I've had a number of patients like that. Also with the fingers, you know, are they able to do their functions? Can they button? I've had a lot of guitar players. Are you able to play the guitar or type, you know, doing texting or typing on your keyboard, that sort of thing?
So one of these agents is actually a monoclonal antibody, Steve, tafasitamab, and you were commenting, and we hear a lot of cases of patients who are on this for a long time. This is an antibody to CD19 as opposed to CD20, for example, rituximab or bendamustine, combined with lenalidomide, again, kind of like the R-squared regimen and lenalidomide rituximab, except it's a different antibody. Can you talk a little bit more about this agent, Steve, and also, again, tolerability toxicity issues?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, target CD19, which is also on the B cell, but is a different target to CD20. So if you kind of feel like CD20 was being overplayed, CD19 creates a different opportunity. It's also an engineered antibody in that it has better antibody drug engagement by macrophages and other phagocytic cells. So those cells do a better job of becoming engaged, and lenalidomide will actually heighten that effect and have a more pronounced kind of immunological effect. Generally, it's very well tolerated. There are some infusion reactions, but most people will tolerate it reasonably well. So I think often it's also getting used to the lenalidomide, and which we often are giving at the same time or around the same time. So it's actually modulating both, but as a combination, actually quite well tolerated. And many times people have come off the back of very heavy treatment like stem cell transplants. So in contrast, this is actually quite easy in contrast.
So the most recent of these that was approved, Robin, was the antibody drug conjugate, again, Lonca-T. And again, getting back to this issue, how you as a team, and you were mentioning there's like 25 people go just to the lymphoma. Imagine that. Just so that you're planning or your clinicians meeting. How did you in April, when all of a sudden the FDA goes, okay, this drug's approved, like how did your team react to it? How long did it take before you were using it? And what kind of issues came up about it?
Well, this particular drug, I believe we've only used it a couple of times. I think mine was the second patient that we started about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So we do have our meetings, as I mentioned. Whenever we have a patient that's starting a new therapy, as a team approach, they meet with a provider, whether that's the consultant or one of us nurse practitioners. And then we also have them meet with our nurse for further education. And they also meet with our pharmacist, not only to go over potential drug interactions, but also to do some further education. But I think the more the patients hear, you know, different ways of us describing what they might go through, the more it'll be retained. And that way we've got all these eyeballs on them, you know, checking labs and symptoms and just to make it as easy as possible for them.
Yeah, I really like the idea of repetition because, you know, people are under such stress that it's really hard to retain stuff. So bring up one other issue about diffuse large B-cell. We've talked about some of the things that have come into the treatment of diffuse large B-cell, but we also know that we're about to have some even greater changes. And it often happens in oncology, you find out about this because of a press release. And we've seen some pretty interesting press releases in the last month or so, Steve. This one was the first one, phase 3 study. So these are big, the largest studies that we do in oncology, typically used to compare a standard of care to a new approach. And there's a phase 3 study that was looking into, we talked about the antibody drug polatuzumab. The idea of now polatuzumab is used in the relapse setting. What about, as is often happens in oncology, bringing it to the upfront setting? So right now, R-CHOP is considered standard first-line therapy. This was compared to to polatuzumab substituting for the vincristine, so R-CHP with polatuzumab. And this press release says the trial is positive. It doesn't say exactly about the specific data, just that, quote, it could be transformative. And we'll see, hopefully. There's a big meeting every year of ASH, American Society of Hematology, in December. You would think that this trial is going to get presented there. Steve, if this actually proves to be something that people say, hey, we better start using this, it's going to be one of the biggest changes in the history of hematologic oncology, because diffuse large B-cell is one of the most common lymphomas. Now we're talking about new first-line therapy. Any thoughts as your team sort of gets ready for the possibility that they might have to be using a new therapy in so many patients, Steve?
Yeah, so I think when you said transformative, that's exactly the word it will be. Because in essence, all, as you mentioned, as that has happened is vincristine was taken out of the combination. Polatuzumab vedotin, as we mentioned, with the similar symptoms, and side effects was put in. And the endpoint of this trial was progression-free survival reported by the investigator, and reportedly that is substantially better, and we need to see the data to see how much better. But we have seen similar antibody drug conjugates for in Hodgkin lymphoma, for example, make an impact on outcome and again then become standard of care. So I would think that we are on the threshold of seeing polatuzumab, R-CHOP equivalent, really becoming our standard of care moving forward, and that's going to change everything. And it's the first time in 20 years we've got something as the new frontline treatment from when R-CHOP took over from CHOP chemotherapy. So this is really a huge step forward.
And here's the actual design of the study. Again, we don't have the specific data. All we know is that it's positive. And you can see that these patients were randomly assigned. And look, they're looking for almost 900 patients. It's a big trial. They want to see if they can see any difference between using polatuzumab instead of vincristine in the R-CHOP regimen. Robin, you sat down with so many patients in your career and said, let me tell you about R-CHOP. And it could be that your conversation's about to change. Anything that you're anticipating? And one of the things that people don't realize is not everybody gets cured with R-CHOP. You know, it's not 100% curative. There's a substantial number of people who relapse. That's why we're just talking about all these therapies. Any sort of anticipation about making this move? Maybe if there's a very traumatic improvement, you're going to want to do it fast. Any thoughts about as you get ready for this, Robin?
As far as teaching the patients, I think it'll be interesting to see what the difference will be as far as, you know, the neuropathy and the infusion reaction risk and that's pretty much what I would think.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good point. It's not just the efficacy data we're looking at. We're looking at toxicity. Who knows? We might see a signal there that's a problem. Polatuzumab hasn't been used in the upfront setting. You wouldn't think it would be any different in terms of toxicity, but you don't know until it happens. So the other gigantic thing that's about to happen in diffuse large B-cell, again, preceded by a bunch of press releases, is Steve. Typically for younger patients, and there are plenty of patients who are older with diffuse large B-cell, autologous transplant or CAR-T is not on the table for them, but it is on the table for many patients who are eligible for either autologous transplant, which up to now for these younger patients in good condition is standard second-line therapy. So if you get R-CHOP first-line and you relapse, right now you're going to get an autologous transplant with high-dose chemo. Now there are three phase three trials, and we've been talking about CAR-T and diffuse large B-cell in the relapse setting after transplant, very effective, one-time treatment, and you have a lot of patients who are disease-free, you know, for prolonged periods. So, of course, a natural thing is, well, let's try moving it earlier. Maybe it's better than transplant. So there have been three big trials attempting to compare CAR-T to autologous transplant. The first one, we see a press release using axicabtagene, which is approved. All three of these are approved in later stage disease, positive trial, supposedly. Then we see another press release comes out, liso-cel, another CAR-T product that's approved in relapse disease. Press release out there, positive trial. We don't know the data. And then the really interesting one is the third trial. So this is another phase three trial, another CAR-T product, tisagenlecel, and this is reportedly negative. So this is going to be real interesting to put together. Steve, I guess it wouldn't be a huge surprise to see CAR-T better than autologous transplant. You know, we can compare them indirectly, but until you really do it in a trial, you don't know. Any thoughts? What are you going to be looking for here?
Yeah, so I think this is going to be, again, potentially transformative as far as how we manage patients, and it's going to be a very closely scrutinized, because I think we want to know for a fact exactly the populations of patients. We'd like to see, you know, why did transplant potentially do better than expected or worse than expected? Why did CAR T cells potentially do better than expected or worse than expected? And the reason this is all going to matter is, you know, autologous transplant has allowed us to really have a defined period when chemo was given and patients went through the process and things were done. And it was relatively, although expensive, not that expensive. This is CAR T cell therapy is a lot more expensive and has a much more profound effect and a lot more longer term low blood count issues and the like. So a lot of this is also going to depend on follow-up to see whether the benefit continues out further. But we always want to see people having a better outcome. And if we see a group of patients benefiting from a new therapy, that's really important.
A lot of times we talk about the treatment of relapse disease and solid tumors, hematologic cancer. A lot of times these people are not curable. But diffuse large B-cell, some of these people appear to be curable, even in the relapse situation. And I guess one of the great things about this, if this really is going to play out the way we think it is you're going to have more people eligible, because the eligibility for CAR T, you can go have people go to CAR T that maybe couldn't go through the high dose chemotherapy with transplant, older patients. Just curious, in the relapse setting right now, what have you seen in older people? You know, people in their 70s, for example, who go to CAR T, particularly who are in pretty good condition. We'll throw it over to Steve. Any thoughts about that?
I think that's true. I think we have been in the past doing transplants up to age 75. So we have seen older patients get an autologous transplant. But I think CAR T cell therapy, we've even been able to push the envelope further. And also, as you get better and better at doing things and you do more in different populations, even high risk elderly patients, you actually can do that quite successfully. So that may broaden the opportunities even for older patients as well.
So let's close out our discussion of diffuse large B-cell with a real-life case. This is 83. We're talking about older people with the diffuse large B-cell, 83-year-old lady. She started out, she actually got R-CHOP in 2018, so I guess she would have been, you know, around 80 at that point. But unfortunately, she relapsed, and she ended up getting one of the drugs we talked about, tafasitamab, although this was on a clinical trial, and it was combined with bendamustine. Robin, anything you want to say about how she did on tafasitamab and bendamustine? And also, what was it like to take care of her as a person? What made it different to take care of her?
Mm-hmm. So she is a very family-oriented person. In fact, you might notice that she delayed starting on the tafasitamide bendamustine trial. She wanted to go to her granddaughter's wedding in the Dominican Republic, so that delayed it. And she said, I don't want to take any harsh chemotherapy. You know, she felt like she's elderly. She's had a good life. But then after she came back and had another scan, had relapsed, she said, okay, we'll try it then. She actually tolerated it very well, went into remission, and she lives 3 hours away from here. And every time that she would come in, we'd say, okay, this is going to continue as long as you're responding, but you can stop anytime you want to. And if this gets to be too much coming back here frequently, we can stop. But she's done well, and she continues to come back now. She's been on this for over 24 months. So she's a determined lady, I would say younger than her stated age of 83 or 84 now, actually.
Interesting. So mm-hmm. Let's move on now. We want to talk a little bit about Hodgkin lymphoma. And again, with this theme of new therapies coming out and how you as a team react to them. Now we're going to look at a therapy that really came out about 5 years ago, but still a new therapy. It kind of reminds me a little bit about what we were just saying with diffuse large B-cell. You know, chemotherapy for Hodgkin lymphoma is curative in a lot of patients, but it hasn't really changed very much until this trial came out. And it is a little bit like what we just talked about with putting in polatuzumab, because here the antibody drug conjugate is brentuximab vedotin that was put into the regimen with AAVD. And Steve, maybe you can talk a little bit about what B vedotin is in terms of this, as an antibody drug conjugate, and how you as a team reacted when you first saw the data. And then now, of course, we have 5 years of follow-up, and there continues to be a difference in these two curves in terms of the relapse rate. Steve, can you just talk a little bit about how you as a team thought this through when it first came out, and kind of how things evolved since that time in terms of your use of this approach?
So as you point out, antibody drug conjugate, very similar to polatuzumab vedotin that we just spoke about, except target CD30, because that's a specific marker on a Reed-Sternberg cell, which is the cancer cell in Hodgkin lymphoma. And as you quite correctly pointed out, the data would say an improvement in, initially it was described the modified progression-free survival, but subsequent studies have shown it's also effective as far as having an impact on the progression-free survival of Hodgkin lymphoma patients in advanced stage. And I think in the beginning, we were a little cautious to say we would use this for high-risk patients. We would use it maybe only in stage four patients. But I think as people have got more comfortable with it, as people have realized that bleomycin out of the mix is actually a very helpful thing, and with the use of growth factor, people actually tolerate the treatment quite well, this has become increasingly accepted. And I would say that most advanced stage patients, particularly if they have poor risk features, are being considered for this as the standard treatment.
So, Robin, we're going to talk in a second about a patient of yours who got treated with this approach, but just sort of taking a step back, again, what are some of the patient education issues that come up in a patient? Typically, you're seeing a younger patient, you know, in their 20s, much more common than an older patient like your patient here. You're a 77-year-old man. These are people who, you know, they may be working in college. You know, they've got a different mindset than the typical oncology patients. What are some of the things that come up in the initial discussion with particularly these younger patients? We'll get to your patient in a second. The more typical patient who's in the middle of their busy life and all of a sudden is dealing with Hodgkin lymphoma.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially the younger people, it can be very socially isolating. Nobody that they're hanging out with is going through this. They're having to interrupt their life, as you said, whether it's their career. I've had a number of people who are in the middle of college and they have to either put their classes on hold or do them online at this point in time. And just the risk of the infection, because this is pretty intensive treatment, getting low blood counts, especially in the time of COVID. But yet we balance it with the hope that they're going to be put in remission and cured. So I'm always their cheerleader, just trying to getting them through from one treatment to the next. And one of the main things is just keeping them to combat the fatigue, trying to keep them active, trying to keep them, manage their side effects. Again, with all of our ancillary nurses and pharmacists working with side effects and just get them from one treatment to the next.
Steve, can you talk a little bit about the alternatives to this regimen with bevacizumab? We know that people react differently to these data. Not everybody's using this newer approach. You mentioned the expense, the need for growth factors. What is the alternative approach? And also, can you talk, you mentioned the fact that alternatively, you're going to be using bleomycin when bleomycin's not part of this regimen. What are some of the issues that come up with using bleomycin, even in younger patients?
Yeah, so you make a few points that are really important. I think it's important to recognize that this data is predominantly in advanced stage patients. When patients have earlier stage disease, when many people develop that initially, treatment can be abbreviated. And many times outside of clinical trials, it's not a standard to use brentuximab vedotin. And in those patients, a BVD chemotherapy may be a very reasonable approach with a plan to omit the bleomycin after at least two cycles of therapy, provided you're having a good response. So there have been trials, even in advanced stage patients, where if you've done well over two cycles of treatment, bleomycin can be omitted. And the bleomycin, as you point out, the biggest challenge there is lung toxicity. And it's not something that's predictable, and it is something that can be pretty severe. And so it's really important for people to be aware of that. And if patients are on bleomycin and get a cough or short of breath or something along those lines, stopping the drug is very important because it can be quite life-threatening if that is a long-term complication, especially in a young patient.
So we're going to hear in a second from Robin about her 77-year-old man. But just to precede that, Steve, of course, again, much more typical to see a younger patient, but you do see people. Here's a 77-year-old man. What's your usual approach? People, usually 77, 80, whatever, are not going to be able to tolerate the same type of intensive chemotherapy that's used in younger patients. How do you approach these people?
Yeah, so very important for people to remember there's actually a bimodal distribution for Hodgkin lymphoma. So there's the young group and then there's the older group. The younger group is more and the older people less, but you're still going to see it just as Robin's patient will illustrate. So in the older patients, as you point out, toxicity is actually quite a substantial issue and tolerating treatment is a problem. So two main strategies that we follow. The first is to say, can you split things up a little bit? And I'm sure she'll illustrate this in just a minute. We use brentuximab vedotin on its own in the beginning for a dose or two just to get the disease calmed down, and then try and bring the rest of the chemotherapy in later, and then bring some more brentuximab vedotin at the back end. That was a regimen pioneered by Andy Evans, and we find it very effective. But sometimes even that's too much. And then you have to kind of pare it down. And there's two ways you can do it. One is that you take out most of the chemotherapy and just work with, for example, dacarbazine plus the brentuximab vedotin. Or there have been some regimens where we've used bendamustine with brentuximab vedotin. But that's still pretty toxic. So sometimes coming down on the chemotherapy isn't as well tolerated as hoped. And then we have in some trials used some of the PD-1 blocking antibodies in combination with brentuximab vedotin as initial therapy. And that's been very effective. But the responses have not been as durable as what we would like. So I think when all is said and done, the idea is to try and stay as true to the initial regimen as possible, unless you really are in a corner and the patient can't tolerate it.
So yeah, the use of checkpoint inhibitors, of course, we talk about that in almost every solid cancer nowadays. But actually the most sensitive cancer to checkpoint inhibitors is actually Hodgkin lymphoma, because these patients have in their tumor amplification of the PD-1 gene. And so we'll see, and people are even with their trials looking at checkpoint inhibitors as part of upfront treatment. But Robin, let's sort of see how this plays out. Again, a little less typical, 77-year-old. You all attempted, as opposed to giving the maybe a little bit less toxic regimen that Steve talked about, bevacizumab alone or with some, you know, one type of chemotherapy. You tried to get the entire sort of magilla in there with this 77-year-old man. Looks like it was a little bit of a challenge. You got him through it, but what happened when you treated him? And also, what about him made him different to take care of?
So one thing that made it different was that this gentleman lives 4 hours away. And so it was a little bit of a challenge. He would always come in with his wife, with his daughter on, she would be calling. And so we were kind of doing a phone visit with her at the same time. So initially, his first two cycles, he did have a little bit of neuropathy, but once he started on the AVD, for whatever reason, he started getting a little bit worse as far as the neuropathy and the just the weakness. So fortunately, we early indicated that he was in a complete remission, and we were able to, instead of give him six cycles, we ended up giving him four. It was complicated by hematuria that he kept having, and he was getting hospitalized, again, 4 hours away from us. So it was very, very complex. But he was able to eventually complete his therapy and even completed two extra doses of BV. We ended up having to dose reduce him. He was one of those gentlemen that I kind of called in the supports. We ended up getting him with exercise physiology to try to make sure he was strong so that he could withstand his therapy and bounce back a little bit quicker than if he were bedridden, for example. So it was, I felt like I was walking on eggshells every time I saw him, but we eventually got him through, and he's now been in remission for a year and a half.
That's really an awesome story. And, you know, it also brings up when you were talking to you about both of your patients so far spent a long time driving in to see you. Maybe that's more typical in your area. But just curious how telemedicine, you know, finally it's on board completely because of COVID. It got shoved down our throats, so to speak, and maybe turned out to be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Do you find that telemedicine is helping with these distant patients particularly?
Yeah, definitely. This one in particular actually was my very first video visit that I did from home, right? Really? When COVID was hitting. Yeah. And, you know, especially with the elderly population, you never know how are they going to take to, you know, a video visit. But his daughter, who was at home, she was able to set them up with their computer, and I was on my iPad at home, and it was really nice. It coincided with his first PET scan that he had at home. Our radiologist read it, so I was able to go over all of that with him virtually. So it was a really nice visit that they didn't have to travel in for. So
you were giving him good news.
I was, yeah.
Interesting. Steve, we could spend the whole time talking about COVID, but you know, it ends up coming in at some point. We'll get back to Hodgkin in a second, but When you look upon across all the lymphomas that we're talking about today, any particular therapies or situations that concern you in terms of maybe affecting the risk of either getting COVID or having a severe case of it? Any concerns in terms of vaccines? The one thing that we've heard in general has been the issue of anti-CD20 antibodies like rituximab and obinutuzumab. How are you dealing with the vaccine and the possibility of COVID and people getting CD20? And are there other therapies that concern you in terms of COVID?
So I think you make a very important point, and that is our lives have completely changed because of COVID, because we get a lot more calls and a lot more questions related to that. And two reasons. One is, as you mentioned, CD20 antibodies deplete your B cells, which turn into plasma cells to make antibodies and thereby decrease your immunity. And BTK inhibitors are the other agent that we use a lot, and they also get affected and affect the B cell and plasma cell function. So, how does that impact our practice? Well, we've tried to do a few things. Number one is, if we don't need to give like maintenance therapy, we've actually held off on doing that. So when patients are in remission, we generally have stopped treatment rather than give people treatment that would put them at risk. We've also really encouraged people to get vaccinated, but to assume they're not, because of the fact that we don't really know how well it takes in patients. And we find the antibody testing kind of unhelpful, because if you test it and it's positive, does that really mean you're totally bulletproof? On the other hand, if you get tested and your antibodies are absent, does that really mean you have no immunity? We don't actually know the answers. So we say, be careful and get vaccinated, but assume that you're not.
Let's move on now. We'll talk about another lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, very common also. Robin has a 76-year-old man she's going to talk about. But again, with this theme of new developments and how it affects practice over time, I picked out really the first two are what I really want to ask about. We'll talk a little bit about CAR-T, which has now been approved in follicular. But I really want to talk about these first two things in terms of new developments. So, Steve, the first is upfront. Again, we're talking about first-line therapy and inpatients who require treatment. We know that a lot of patients with follicular lymphoma can be observed for a long period of time without treatment. Maybe they could even get rituximab monotherapy. But for patients who need more treatment, in the past, bendamustine and rituximab was a standard. And then 3 years ago, we saw, again, a phase 3 trial comparing the standard BR to a non-chemotherapy approach, the so-called R-squared regimen, lenalidomide and rituximab that we were talking about before. And Steve, to me, this is really interesting in terms of how, you know, clinical research gets translated to practice, because basically the trial showed that R-squared looked very, very similar to BR, not much of a difference. And yet you didn't see that many docs in practice switching over to R-squared. BR continued in general to be first-line therapy. R-squared is very often second-line therapy. Can you talk a little bit again, Steve, about how your team processed it? After that ASCO meeting, Dr. Fowler presented these data. You sat down and said, okay, are we going to give R-squared up front? How you process it and what happened between then and now?
Yeah, so I think the main thing was, as you point out, that this showed equivalence. And so I think it's quite legitimate to do either of these two approaches, bendamustine, rituximab versus the R-squared regimen. I think it really comes down to duration of therapy. And I think that's really kind of where things kind of sort of became more critical. So in our practice, we don't use a lot of maintenance rituximab. So it's a case of, can you give 4 to 6 rounds of treatment and then be done? Versus no, you're going to need to be giving at least a year and then longer for therapy when you use the R-squared regimen. So I think it really just came down to what suits the patient and the physician the best. And I think we, in our practice, generally speaking, have still maintained the bendamustine rituximab as our frontline for younger and fitter patients. For the older, more fragile patient, then the R-squared regimen is very reasonable. And we commonly will use R-squared as a second line in the younger patients if bendamustine plus rituximab fails. However, I would say that this is a very appropriate treatment, generally pretty well tolerated, although often we do over time need to make some modifications in the dose, for example, of the rituximab, of the lenalidomide.
It's always interesting to see how people react to new data. And as you say, one of the things that in the actual trial, they used the R-squared regimen for, I think it was more than 2 years.
Correct.
And that sort of turned off a lot of people. Actually, MD Anderson that developed that, they then started using it in their own practice like 6 months or a year, but everybody else was looking at the trial. So anyhow, but Robin, you actually have a patient here, a 76-year-old man, who fits into the category Steve was just talking about, somebody who you really didn't want to give chemotherapy to. Can you talk about your encounter with this man?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So this was interesting. He was definitely one of those folliculars that you needed to treat. He wasn't somebody that you would observe because they had very extensive disease. And when he was diagnosed, he was just, they were just starting to uncover there were some neurological problems that were continuing. And in fact, when he was diagnosed, we needed to make sure that it wasn't related to lymphoma. So once we decided we were going to treat him, and as Steve pointed out, we often would have chosen BR. But with this gentleman with his other comorbidities and now his new diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and again, this is somebody who lives 3 hours away, it was determined that we want to give him something that would hopefully be better tolerated. So we thought, let's give him a trial on R-squared. And fortunately, he tolerated it reasonably well. He certainly did require some dose adjustments, as Steve alluded to, due to rash and neutropenia. But fortunately, as time went on, we learned that, yes, indeed, he achieved a complete remission. So because of the extent of his disease, as Steve pointed out, we generally don't consider rituximab maintenance, you know, for a prolonged period of time after this, but he was somebody that we might have thought about treating for with rituximab maintenance after he completed the R-squared for initial therapy. However, during all of this, and his poor wife, you know, he lived at home with her despite his progressive dementia. He began to require 24-hour care at home. We ended up getting social work involved to see how this could help her at home know what to do with him. She couldn't even leave for an hour for a hair appointment, for heaven's sakes. So it became more and more difficult to get him here. They were definitely somebody that we ended up doing virtual visits with. We couldn't do it video, but we were doing phone visits and checking labs and seeing how he was doing. But eventually it just got to be too much to even come back. The last time he was here, I believe, was a couple of months ago in August, and he had a scan. He was in complete response still, and we just decided, okay, we're just going to observe at this point. So,
yeah, I can imagine when he was first diagnosed with lymphoma, I'm sure he and his wife probably thought that was going to be the thing that would be his problem. It turns out it really is in complete remission, but the Alzheimer's much more of a problem. Steve, another thing that's developed in terms of new developments is a new agent called tazemetostat. It kind of fits into the oncology theme of targeted therapy with a tissue biomarker. Can you explain what tazemetostat is, how it works, how you decide whether to use it, and what kinds of efficacy and tolerability do you see?
So this is an agent that inhibits a gene and a gene products called EZH2, and it's a regulator of gene expression and really controls how cells behave. And it has to do with the process of B cells through the activation center, the germinal center, and exactly which cells kind of come through and which cells get held back. And if it's dysregulated, you get uncontrolled growth of cells, and that's the risk of getting a disease like follicular lymphoma. So if you have this mutation, you can actually be very sensitive to inhibition of EZH2. And tazemetostat is actually an agent that initially showed dramatic differences between EZH2 mutants and those that were not. However, as we've had more data and more time, it turns out that even the ones that are not mutated may still benefit, and we see that response rate actually coming up quite a lot more than we might have anticipated. And in general, this is actually a very well-tolerated therapy, so it's a treatment that we are beginning to use more and more, and often we'll use even whether there's a mutational status of EZH2 or not, just because it's well-tolerated oral medication. Now, there is a gene test, and I certainly encourage people to consider using that to know whether there's mutation of EZH2, but it doesn't mean if you don't have the mutation that this may not be a therapy that could be used.
And just to clarify that a little more, if you look at the data here, on the two columns on the right. So first you see WT, that's wild type. So that means there is no EZH2 mutation. Response rate 35%, you know, pretty good. But then you look to the last column on the right, MT, mutated EZH2, the response rate's on pretty much double of that. So as Steve points out, both groups do a benefit, but the one with the target benefits the most. Any other go ahead, Steve.
No, just to say, I mean, I think the thing that's really interesting is that when you look at the duration of benefit and the progression-free survival, they actually look quite similar. So I think even though the responses may be a little different, the durability of the benefit really seems to be similar in both groups.
So I want to talk a little bit also about mantle cell lymphoma, less common, but still a lot of research, a lot of new developments. And in a second, we'll hear about a very unusual case that Robin has of mantle cell lymphoma. But the two big things that have happened in this lymphoma are, first of all, the introduction of Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So starting out with ibrutinib and now the second generation of acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib. Of course, we talk about this all the time when we talk about CLL. Well, in a second, we'll get into the difference between these BTK inhibitors. But now BTK inhibitors are known to be very effective in mantle cells. It's the typical first treatment that's given in a patient who relapses. And Steve will talk about kind of how first-line therapy goes. But the other really dramatic development in mantle cell, and this we showed some slides before with follicular lymphoma and diffuse large B cells, CAR-T therapy. So CAR-T, brexucaptogene, very similar to axi-cell, slightly different but similar. Very effective in mantle cell and is often considered in patients after BTK inhibitors. So again, Steve, can you talk about, you know, it wasn't that long ago when we didn't have, there was neither of these options were out there. Lenalidomide was often used with the R-squared regimen, for example, that we talk about relapse disease. Bortezomib was occasionally used. All of a sudden, the BTK and CAR-T came on. Can you talk about what we know about these new advances, Steve, and how they've been introduced by your team to your patients?
So I will tell you again, this is an area that has moved so fast, and it used to be kind of straightforward, but it actually has become increasingly complex. But I think in principle, frontline treatment, we still consider an aggressive approach with autologous stem cell transplant in younger patients, a less aggressive sort of bendamustine rituximab approach in older patients. But when patients relapse, and unfortunately I said when on purpose because this is a disease that we're not sure that we cure, although we're hoping that there will be a very durable remission, it is likely that they will require treatment subsequently. The use of BTK inhibitors has really become a highly effective strategy, which we will commonly use as the next line therapy. And then, as you mentioned, the data are looking really exceptional for CAR T cell therapy, and that's something that we will consider. What we don't yet have is totally long-term follow-up of CAR T cell data, because to the best of my understanding of the field at this point, I'm not clear that there's a plateau in patients with mantle cell lymphoma like there is where we see in large cell lymphoma. So in large cell lymphoma, we certainly believe there are a subset of relapse patients that are cured by CAR T cell therapy. We're not totally sure of that in mantle cell. But should that be the case in time, that would also then move CAR T cell therapy further up the order of things, because obviously if something cures the disease, you want to utilize that sooner. But in our thinking, it would be the chemotherapy approach with or without an autologous transplant first, and then subsequently BTK type therapies and CAR T cell therapies to follow thereafter.
And of course, when you talk about plateau and the curve, you're talking about the curve for relapse. And
correct.
What we know, because we have more follow-up with diffuse large B cell also, is just like upfront treatment with R-CHOP, some of these, you know, after a while you stop seeing relapses and there's still people in complete remission. That's the plateau. That's
correct.
What we're looking for when we give CAR-T. So we don't know quite yet whether we're going to see that. We see it in diffuse large B cell, and that's part of why it's moving up earlier. Getting back to BTK, Robin, we don't see often trials, phase three trials that compare two agents in the same class. But we actually in CLL saw two trials like that this past summer. First, we at ASCO, we saw a trial directly comparing ibrutinib to acalabrutinib in CLL, not mantle cell, but in CLL. And there we saw just kind of what people expected, similar efficacy, but different tolerability. Less atrial fibrillation was a big finding there, because that's a concern with the BTK inhibitors. Zanubrutinib is another second generation that was also compared in a phase 3 trial in CLL. Again, less atrial fibrillation. There are a lot of other problems you can see with BTK inhibitors, arthralgias, et cetera. And these two agents seem to be better tolerated. Now, we have to sort of adapt that tolerance profile to mantle cell. But just curious what your experience is. I don't know if you've used all three of these, Robin. I'm sure you've used acalabrutinib and ibrutinib. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about the kinds of problems people on BTK have or can have?
Yeah, I think I probably see in my practice we use a bit more acalabrutinib now. I have had a patient or two maybe on zanubrutinib in the CLL population, and I believe I see a little bit more bleeding complications with that, at least in the patients that I had. So I think for that reason, and as you pointed out, the less risk for atrial fibrillation, we use a bit more acalabrutinib. Acalabrutinib, we definitely see the initial headache that they can have for the first few weeks. It typically goes away. We often watch their blood counts, but I have not really seen too much problems with needing to reduce their dose or anything like that. And as you mentioned, the arthralgias, and also the thing about the ibrutinib nails, not a lot of people might know about that, but if they've been on it for any length of time, they have some definite thinning and brittle nails on ibrutinib. I'm not sure that I've seen it on acalabrutinib yet, but.
We actually did an entire webinar on Monday of this week on tolerability issues with novel agents. We spent like a half an hour talking about BTK inhibitors. Nobody brought up the nail thing. I never heard that before.
Really? Yeah.
Yes. Steve, you've seen this, nail problems with the ibrutinib?
I would say that yes, I have. I wouldn't say I have a lot of them. And one of the reasons is that Robin is so great in seeing many of the follow-up patients.
So you don't even know they have the problem.
Yeah, well, my hope is that I do. But again, you know, we have a great practice where our nurse practitioners and our PAs are very involved in the ongoing longer-term follow-up with patients. So they get to be able to inform us of some of those longer-term toxicities. I do think, though, that, you know, as you mentioned, the toxicities, weighing up kind of what toxicities are seen with each of these BTK inhibitors are really important, because it may affect one's choices. So, for example, if you have more in the way of the atrial fibrillation or clotting problems or bleeding problems, there may be a concern about ibrutinib. But on the other hand, if you're more concerned about low blood counts, for example, and the patient coming in after previous transplant with low counts, then something like zanubrutinib may be a little bit more challenging. So I think there's place for all of these agents because their profiles of toxicities are a little different.
Yeah, we actually had a cardiologist on this webinar, and it was just, you know, there's that much to talk about. You know, not just atrial fibrillation, ventricular arrhythmias they we were talking about. Really interesting. Just kind of curious, and we're going to finish up in a second with Robin's mantle cell case. Curious where you see things heading in first-line therapy, Steve. You know, in CLL, there's been a lot of interest in combining. You know, of course, the two first-line therapies are either venetoclax with anti-CD20, or BTK, and now we're seeing trials like the GLOW study, GLOW, just presented this summer, combining BTK and venetoclax and sometimes CD20. There's also a trial looking at ibrutinib, I believe it's ibrutinib, now BTK plus chemo immunotherapy like BR as upfront therapy. We're waiting for that trial to come in. Steve, where do you see these heading? Do you think we're going to be using BTK first line with chemo? And what about the combination that looks so good in CLL of venetoclax and BTK?
Well, I think if we've actually specifically followed what's happened to date with BTK inhibitors, we've followed CLL kind of all the way along the road. So I would not be shocked if we continue to do that. I will say this much. I think that in the future, we're probably going to see intensive chemotherapy dropping down substantially. We may even see autologous transplant become less of a thing because we don't need to pound people as hard as we have in the past to get the level of the disease as low, because we can achieve that with novel agents. So I think the next thing we will see is the use of BTK inhibitors plus chemotherapy as frontline. And I would not be shocked if shortly thereafter we see the use of multiple novel agents in first line therapy as primary treatment, something like venetoclax plus a BTK inhibitor right off the bat. However, what I would love to see is one of these combinations resulting in curative therapies. And I think that's still something that's a bit of a misnomer for us. We're not yet at the point where we're curing people, but that's really the goal.
So let's finish out with a mantle cell case. Again, I personally haven't heard about a case like this. This patient actually had leptomeningeal disease, Robin. And when Steve was looking at the case before, he was pointing out the fact that with more and more effective therapies, as people get farther down the line, you see this in breast cancer, more CNS involvement that you don't see early on. Maybe that's what happened with your patient who was initially diagnosed in 2011 and then actually ended up with this CNS involvement in 2013. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like taking care of this woman and also what made it different to take care of her? I see she was a gift shop owner. What was it like to take care of her with this really terrible CNS problem?
Well, she was really a delightful person. She and her husband both, and she had a daughter as well who is growing up to be just like her. Everybody loved her. She had lived 8 hours away, so she would come here 8 hours for her treatment. And, you know, she's somebody who, she did everything right. She got the Nordic regimen, had the autologous transplant in first remission back in 2011. And when she relapsed in 2013, I should have thought something was up. This disease is going to be different. Because a lot of times they'll get 5 years or so out of it. But she had CNS relapse. And at that time, we treated her with the methotrexate and rituximab. But then she relapsed again in 2017. And at that point, she was willing to do anything that we could. And we started thinking outside the box and just came up with giving her the ibrutinib. I have to tell you a brief, funny story about that. You know, we educate all of our patients when they're on ibrutinib or one of the BTK inhibitors to, you know, be mindful if you're going to have an invasive procedure. So one of her follow-ups was to do a lumbar puncture. We always told her, okay, hold your dose for, you know, 3 days, whatever beforehand. But she came in one day, had her lumbar puncture. Oh, darn. I forgot to stop the ibrutinib. So we all panicked, of course, but she did just fine. And she was actually on ibrutinib for 3 years before she relapsed, relapsed basically, because she did go into remission on that. And then when it did come back here back in September, it came back with a vengeance, because when she came back diagnosed, she not only had leptomeningeal disease, she had bone marrow disease to the point where she was pancytopenic and it was necrotic. You couldn't even get any excellent biopsy for that. So we started her on a couple of treatments, talked to her about CAR T cell therapy, and they were kind of wondering, is that what I want to do? Finally decided they would want to, but then her disease had already progressed, in fact, to the point where she had masses in her brain in addition to the leptomeningeal. So very sad story with this great new therapy. She just wasn't able to even get to that. And she actually, unfortunately, died a couple of months ago.
So, you know, when you first started talking about her, Robin, I was watching your face and you had a special look on your face, a smile, a feeling that I can just read on your face. You know, you could look at this as a situation where you weren't able to succeed in curing her. But do you feel a sense of, looking back on her case, a sense of satisfaction in having managed her and her case?
Absolutely. She was a person that if she was in your life, even if she was in a patient, she made people's lives better. A lot of times we talked about things not related to her lymphoma. We talked about her kids. She always asked about mine. And that's still the case. She just was one of those bright stars in the world.